high and a hoo.
All right, all right. Good morning, y'all. Brother A-Dub down here live 90.1 FM on your listening dial. Sister Carol is joining me in the studio. The views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, Prairie Air, Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. That just means I said it. Holler at me about it if you got an issue with it, you agree with it, disagree with it. You can give us a call down here, 217-359-5483, 217-359-5483, or you can try 217-359-6545. And so this morning we're going to have a pretty lively show, as usual, and we want you to participate, so I hope you wrote that number down. Because we definitely want you to call in and offer your input, ask your questions, or make a comment. Hot times in America, all over the place. The Republican circus was going on in Cleveland, full of all types of all different manner of things and all types of statements that I'm sure we will touch on as we move forward. So this morning you'll be hearing from Sister Carol and myself. We'll be talking about, you know, just the latest things that are going on here, giving you some announcements, some updates on what's happening in our cities, our twin cities. Then our special guest this morning from 8:30 to about 9:30 will be none other than Professor Sundiata Chajua, historian from the University of Illinois, brother that we all know in the community, who is out here giving us some insight and some direction on how we should move forward as we deal with the constant repression and attempts of oppression that we see on a regular basis. So he will be on with us from 8:30 to 9:30, discussing his latest article, his latest column in the News Gazette. And this one deals with resistance and repression, dealing with the shootings in Dallas of the police officers, as well as the continuous and constant murders of civilians and citizens by police officers. So those of you who want to chime in on that conversation, that one will begin from 8:30 to 9:30, but the lines will be open for those of you who want to join in that conversation. So we want you to stay tuned, and we'll be bringing the heat this morning with your support and your help. I want to give a shout out to my brother Amon Gray. I know he's always listening. He said, "I missed y'all the last time you were supposed to be on because the radio was down." So I know he's up early listening because he get up before the birds do while getting his workout in, going live, showing y'all how to get your fit on and how to get a little swole on. What's up to you, brother Amon? Dante Live Action Lots. Big brother Byron, president of National Council of African American Men. To my mama, my daddy, my sister Deanna Unique, my brother Gerald, sisters Adrian, Tanya, Tina, Alicia, you know, to Pat, Mickey, Jay, Toddy, and Amir, to the Breakfast Club, all y'all out there, good morning. Hopefully you picking up the phone, call somebody else and tell them get out to bed like Brother Sean did. So and come on down here to the show instead of just calling in. We love y'all, appreciate y'all. So we have some announcements. Sister Carol, why don't you go and say something to the people?
Good morning. Well, my big announcement is we are leaving here this morning right when we leave the station, and we are going to the Democratic National Convention to represent Champaign-Urbana, the state of Illinois. I'm a whip, y'all, so I'm going to try to whip some votes into place there. I don't know how to do that, but we'll figure it out. And so Brother A-Dub and I will both be on the floor as delegates. This will be our first time, so it should be an interesting experience. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. But
so one of the things that I wanted to do before we lost the opportunity to do it is, why don't you give us a little bit of a recap? And I was there as well. I could share with some of the people about the expungement workshop that your office and Education Justice Project with Rebecca Ginsburg, you all did, had a luncheon sort of thing, a one-on-one with people, and also the seminar, the introductory type of thing at the library.
So we partner with, meaning the state rep office that I am in, we've set up a series of workshops and sessions that will help people directly with, you know, some of their issues that they have and they want to get back into employment. One of them is, you know, really dealing with this expungement issue. If you've had some issue in the past where you had a criminal background, some of those things can be expunged or sealed so that you can move on and get jobs. And so we partnered with Education Justice Project that teaches in Danville Correctional Center, Ms. Rebecca Ginsburg and all of the teachers there. And we also partnered with Cabrini Green Legal Aid from Chicago, who specialize in helping people actually submit their applications for expungement or sealing. So they came down to our office. We planned a full day. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to be there because we had another event going on at the same time, which I'll tell you about. But we partnered together. They came and helped people. We selected clients that sent us a request to help them with their sealing documents. So the attorneys from Cabrini Green Legal Aid came to the office, spent half the day at the office working one-on-one with individuals that want to submit applications for sealing or expungement to the clerk's office. That was very successful, and we were able to help people in that way. Later that evening, of course, we had a full workshop at the Champaign Public Library to introduce it to other people who may not have been able to get that opportunity that day. And you can talk about that experience because I missed majority of it. I got that kind of late.
Well, I was actually had an opportunity to experience the sort of powwow with some of the what do we call them, stakeholders in the community who were interested in being supportive of this this movement of and this type of work going forward. Right. You know, there's a date set for October 22nd where there's going to be a actual summit of expungement, sealing and all that kind of stuff. And that's going to be at Stone Creek Church. We don't have any specific details on it just yet, but stay tuned to that. But there was a little powwow of folks there to talk about that, to see how we can move that forward. And then the one-on-ones, there were several people, I'm not going to call folks name out, who I know who came and sat down to take advantage of that one-on-one opportunity and that tremendous amount of experience that Cabrini Green Legal in Chicago. Cynthia Cornelius and Beth Johnson, I think is her name, were the two attorneys who came down. Just extraordinary amount of history. They've been doing these summits in Chicago, expungement workshops for over a decade in Chicago, and they've learned a lot and they have a tremendous amount of experience. So they gave one-on-one help with them and their interns to several people who came in and had appointments for them with them. And I took advantage of that. And they, a lot of people see that I got the pardon and they think that everything was just completely wiped clean because of that. The reality is that even with the pardon, mm-hmm. I still have to go through the expungement process. It's just that they can't stop it because the pardon came from the governor, right? But there's a tremendous amount to learn about that. I'm not going to try to get into all that. But everybody from class X to misdemeanor, there is something in this for you, right? Some people's stuff cannot be expunged, cannot be sealed, but there are other things that you can do that are very, very, very helpful for you. So don't get discouraged. We're going to have called a room of hope, a hope room, because there's some people who get discouraged when they think that their stuff can't be, nothing can be done. There's a lot of stuff that can be done. You have a very powerful state representative who will take issues to Springfield and can expand the pool of things that can be expunged.
We
and
just
sealed.
Added, I think, four or five other exactly areas this year.
And way back in 2004, when we first started working on this, mm-hmm. the only felony that could be expunged was a class four prostitution felony. Now there's several things that fall into that category, right? Way back when we did that forgiveness weekend in 2004, that was the only thing that was on there. That's why your state representative and state senator is so important, because they get to change those particular laws. And if we don't, there was a group of people in a video, in a picture that we showed at the library workshop, who all had felony convictions, who worked with Cabrini Green Legal, and who took turns going to Springfield every day. It was about six or seven of them. They rotated, because the people who are affected by it directly are going to have the stories and can give you the experiences to help you write the law. Right. So we're going to form a group. We got a second chance group that we're going to do meetings at Carol's office. Some people signed up for that. So it was a very effective day. I was able to take advantage of that. And then that evening, there was probably, I don't know, 50 or 60 people who came in the room, all walks of life. The people all who were sitting in that room, you would be amazed who has felony convictions, right? Many people who have moved on with their lives and stuff and have made the most of what they could, but they are still haunted by that. And it's still chasing them, so to speak. So everybody felt like it was a very good workshop. They got a ton of good information. And it was set up so that people can know what to do to get started. But we still have a lot of work to do around it. But it was it was very helpful. Everybody felt that they got fed from that experience.
This is our fourth workshop. We've done them on different topics to try to help support families. I mean, we'll talk about this morning. It's hard to pass, you know, an African-American family and they not be affected by some probation, parole, or prison.
Mm-hmm. Felony conviction.
In mm-hmm. their lives. And so we've made this a part of what we do every 3 months. So we have had, this is our fourth workshop and our last one for this year, but we'll do others in the mm-hmm. years to come.
And I just wanted to say a quick word about Education Justice Project, because a lot of people have no idea. Rebecca Ginsburg and all of the different teachers that work with her, this is a dedicated woman who picked up this mantle and would not let it go. And she's just, this is what she's focused on other than her family, right? This is what she does. And she worked until, right now, Danville Correctional Facility has classes, and the folks there who are, at Danville Correctional Center are students because they are learning,
the same university coursework,
right? And it was amazing because I was watching Good Morning America one day, and they had some lady out in, I don't know if it was Harvard or Columbia or whatever, who was also doing the same thing, right? And so he was getting all this positive recognition, and Illinois and the EJP project was not mentioned. But it goes to show you that there's good work that goes on that people don't know about, you know, but this is growing. And even at those Harvard, Columbia schools, they are actually teaching them the same coursework that they teach everybody else. And this one particular teacher, and Rebecca would probably say the same thing. She said, look, I've been teaching this Shakespeare course or whatever for years, right? The students that she was in the prison that she was visiting or she was working in, she said they was teaching her stuff about Shakespeare, right? You know, so we have these misnomers about people because they have made a mistake in their life and they got caught up and they incarcerated, that they stupid, that they don't have any sense or something like that, that they, you know what I mean? It's like there's all this stigma wrapped around it.
They don't have the capacity to learn it. And we've seen that, you know, EJP was recognized this year at the White House. And so it's not certainly because they've not been on television mm-hmm. that the program has not been recognized nationwide as an effective, strong program coming out of Illinois. And so we'll talk more. We'll have Rebecca on. We'll talk more about EJP and the work that they do. But it's a fantastic opportunity as an elected person to say we need to have laws that allow people to really grow and develop and to serve their community.
Yeah. So why don't you touch on the golf outing real quick, the scholarships, and then we're going to get into this with Sean.
So the same day, the reason why I didn't make the entire day for our summit was really based on us giving away scholarships for college to high school students. Mm-hmm. So we had two high school students from here that were selected from the Illinois Legislative Black Caucus through our scholarship initiative, and we gave scholarships to each of these students. Ivana Green is one from here, and Wanjel Harvey Robinson is the other, and both of them are spectacular young women. We gave away two last year as well at Champaign-Urbana Days. This year we gave them away at the golf outing hosted by the Black Caucus. Now, we gave away $62,000. We don't raise much money as a Black Caucus. All of our money that we raise is primarily spent on either our executive director or these scholarships. That's the number one thing that we do. And so this was my first year actually going to the scholarship outing, which was supported by just a number of really great organizations, people, and companies. And so it was a great opportunity for Ivana and for Wanjel from here to, in essence, be on the map, right? We would not have been included except that I'm a African American that's a member of the Illinois Legislative Black Caucus. I'm a member of the Democratic Caucus and the Downstate Caucus, but I'm also a member of the Black Caucus, which gives us the additional scholarship opportunities that wouldn't otherwise exist. And mm-hmm. so those two young ladies are going to do some spectacular work in their lives. They're great students, and I can't wait to see what they do from here on out. So I ran from there, drove all the way back to Champaign-Urbana, and went to the library so that I can greet Cabrini Green Legal Aid as well.
Yes, indeed.
And the people there.
All right, all right. So thank you, Sister Carol. I voted for you, too. I think
thank
I'm probably
so going to
vote for you again.
I hope so. I really do.
All right, also joining us down here in the studio this morning is Brother Sean Williams.
Good morning, Brother Sean.
Williams Memorial Service, the Whip Barbershop, insurance, you name it, old school, riding, everything, right? Got him out to bed this morning because he's working on something that's extremely important. The entire community is mourning the loss of the four family members who died in Florida, Wiggins and Davis family. So Sean came down this morning to share a few words with us about what's going on with that and give us an update on fundraising and all that.
You know, I thank the Lord for being here and being up in the studio and just having another opportunity to wake up, to be able to help myself, help my family and community. I'm listening to you guys and I'm watching you go back and forth. And it's a song, you know, if I look back over my life, and I kind of just did that little experience with you guys and just bouncing back over your life and just where you come from and just how profound God has did some amazing things with, whether if it's education, what you're doing in the state legislature. I mean, it just brought kind of got teary eyed a little bit just listening to you. But I thank the Lord for the work that you're doing, Sister Carol. I mean, the community definitely needs it. The work that you're doing to support your wife and what you guys are doing in the community, because you know, it's just small things sometimes, you know, that's overlooked. And you guys talked about it, the small things. And I know that, you know, you mentioned all these different caucuses and all these different meetings. And I'm wondering, how can you do it? You know, and how can you make all this happen?
Yeah, we're a team, Brother A-Dub took care of the one here. And I was in the one in Chicago and came on back. You know, we really are a team. And a young brother asked us this yesterday. We was out having pizza and he was unsure if he could say it, but he says, "Well, how hard is it on the marriage?" And I said, we're a team. I mean, we really do roll together and we touch and agree. And we debate it through until we get to the solution and balance it out.
And I think, you know, we've always said that our marriage is supposed to be expansive, meaning that other people can sort of join in because we're married to a certain set of principles and stuff first. And then we do marriage together.
Right.
It doesn't mean that it's not challenging. It doesn't mean that I don't have moments of insecurity or like, who was that? You know, what's up with all them brothers down there, them peacocks down there strutting up trying to get next to you and stuff like that, right? I'm just, you know, I'm going to put it out there for real. It's not, look, man, it was years ago, I'd have been driving up and down Springfield in the middle of the night trying to see what's going on, right? You know what I'm saying? So I had to grow personally as an individual over the years, and the work that we did through atonement and all that, that where I came from, I look back over my life, I had to do a tremendous amount of soul searching and be secure with myself and let other people live their life, because I can't control what other people do. So that helps me even now, right? And so we draw on that, you know, but I'm committed to my wife.
Yeah.
I firmly believe she's committed to me. So I'm not going to let myself, you know, go crazy worrying about some of that stuff. But it's not a privilege, y'all. It's a sacrifice that people do to serve in this capacity, right? You know, it has some perks. Ain't no sense in lying about that. But it's a sacrifice, and we do it because we love the people.
Yeah, you know? And you can tell within the work. You can tell the heartfeltness in the work. It's almost you mentioned Williams Memorial Services. You know, as I deal with these families, you know, you gotta commit yourself to these families. And everybody's situation is different. Everybody's families is different. When you mentioned, when you called me on the phone, I got up early this morning. I was up about 5:30, and I called another one of my friends that I know that's up. He was in the military, and that was Brother Hub. I said, "Soldier, I know you're up this morning." And I sat back and dialogued with him this morning, then jumped back into bed. But when you called me, I felt committed to my family to come down to the studio to be able to give it one-on-one, to let you know of the information that we need to be able to assist this family. The goal is to do a full funeral service and to do burial. The daughter wants to bury mom, wants to definitely bury her daughters and bury her grandchild. And that can be an astronomical cost. Mm-hmm. The cost to get them back here was well over $6,000 to just get them back here. And we'll be doing that on this week, just getting them back in the area and getting mom back to her family. And so we're trying to raise the team here and that was with Dwayne Hubbard and them. I don't want to mention their group. They've been having a goal on GoFundMe to raise up to $45,000. So that's the goal, is to raise $45,000. We have a memorial fund set up in the Wiggins Davis Memorial Fund at the University of Illinois Credit Union.
Okay.
And so that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to assist these this family into to getting their loved ones to some rest in peace. And so so if you can help out in any capacity, I've had people call me from all over the community. I went and sat with a lady over in West Champaign, and she said she felt compassion to give, and she gave a $200 donation. I brought a family member with me from the house, mm-hmm. and we went over there and picked that up, and I took a picture of her, and she prayed with us in the household, and it's been an emotional roller coaster ride. I mean, just not for just the family, but for me, just sitting there listening to the story and trying to pick her spirits up, you know, because, you know, it's tough enough to lose one loved one. But when you lose four loved ones all in one WAP, that's a tremendous blow. And so I always say, when someone's hurting in our community, we should always feel the blow. And even if you can't give them 50 cents, you should feel the blow, because you can be in that shoes, those same shoes. And that's what that lady was talking about over in West Champaign. Mm-hmm. She said, my kids go up and down to Florida all the time, up and down the highway. And that could have been my family. Mm-hmm. And that's where what compelled her heart to give.
Well, it also takes, in my opinion, someone with the heart that you have to serve in the capacity that you do. You've always had that heart. You know, we've gone back and forth. And even if we disagree on something, the one thing that I've never, ever questioned was your heart. Right. And I think that you wear that on your sleeve. And I think that's a wonderful position for you to be in, to be able to serve and help the families in the way that you do. And I know that we've learned, and we're going to get into this campaign later on, watching the average donation be $27 from citizens all over the world, but raised millions and millions and millions of dollars for Bernie. Right. So we've learned from this process that one thing that we want to try to harp on, like you said, you may think your $50 or your $10 or your 50 cent doesn't mean anything. But when that total hit that 40,000 or that 45,000, every penny counted.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Yeah. And some people are going to give and give more because they can give more. Yeah. Right. You know, their conviction may be different. I don't know. But everything, every bit is still going to count. So we certainly ask folks to think about this family, to feel what this family is feeling and feel for them, and to give what you possibly can. University of Illinois Credit Union. There is a GoFundMe page. There's the GoFundMe process does give you, they do get a cut out of it somehow, but it still creates an opportunity for people to get all over the world to be able to give and to donate. So certainly you all, hey, listen, Wiggins Davis Memorial Fund, U of I Credit Union. As a community, let's bring this family home, have the memorial service for them so that their family members can rest in peace and we can start to heal as a community in that capacity. So I'm going to thank you, brother, for everything that you do and the service that you offer the community. And we're going to do whatever we can to try to help make that happen.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The unfortunate, the mom came to my house. We have some African students from all over the African continent at the U of I this summer. And one of them asked me, well, how do you stay connected with your constituents? I say, they come to my house. And he couldn't believe it. But she did. She stopped. She came over to the house. And I had read it in a newspaper when it first happened, but I didn't know the family. And mom came over with a friend of mine and told me about the. And the first thing I asked her is, have you spoken to Sean? And she said, oh, yeah, Sean is helping us. I said, well, let us call Sean first. I don't want to step into something that I don't have direction on. And so Brother Aaron reached out to you, and got the information, because we know you're going to do the right thing by the family. Yeah. And so, we're going to help, you know, move. And if I can get the link, it would be easier for me to help move the link, which I don't have the details on that, but we can get that from you, to move it through our networks so that people can help finish this off.
Definitely.
And then, unfortunately, I didn't know what to say. You know, it's for her to lose her mom, both her daughters and her grandson. That's real close to us, you know, close to home. So I know it's going to be a very difficult process just thinking about that.
Oh, yeah.
For her, and she's staying with a friend of mine, you know, just for support right now. But we will definitely help move that process.
Oh, that's your friend.
She from East St. Louis. That's all I can say.
I met her,
and
you know, and that's what you need. I mean, sometimes a good friend in those times.
I don't know how they knew each other, but
we was able to you know, just love on her. You know, like you just said, things to say. You know, sometimes it's just best just to be around there. It's more support and let them tell you some things.
Yeah.
And that's what happened when we first met up with her. Just kind of sat there with her. She was very, very numb and just kind of opened up. And I started talking to her about small things. Don't want to pressure you into doing too much today, you know, because you got to take it in small increments. And I was able to get on the phone and make some phone calls for her. That was very, very hard phone calls for her to make.
Yeah.
And we did that and took her out to lunch and loved on her all day long and kind of let her listen to a little music in the car. And I spent the whole day with her, and then spent the next day with her. Then we did the candlelight vigil and, you know, and just doing everything that we could possibly do to make her feel comfortable. You know, because that's what she need at that time. So I thank the Lord for you.
We appreciate you. We'll definitely reach back again. You know, we headed out and I did share with her what was going on with us. But we will definitely, if I can get the link, just email it to me. We'll get it moving. We'll get it moving.
If you see some TV cameras, stand up, give Champagne Urbana a shout out.
You know it. You know it. We can't go nowhere without me doing the Champagne Urbana. So
it's a very powerful thing, actually, the networking opportunities that will exist. And touching base with other organizations while we're out there. So we need to make sure we have very clear direction and instructions on how to make those connections for people who are out of town. What if there is an organization out of town that wants to make a contribution? We need to know how they can do that from a distance.
Well, we do have a network of organizations we work with, and so we'll try to move it through our network from Oakland all the way to Philadelphia. So we'll move through the network and try to get this done so
the Democratic Convention is in.
It's in Philadelphia.
It's in Philadelphia.
All right. Mm-hmm. All right.
That's where we're headed.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. You guys driving?
We're taking an adventurous road trip. You'll be able to follow us on Facebook. All right. So, you know, we're going
to. Yeah, I'm trying to make some space so I can do some live video.
Some live video.
Okay. From the convention floor.
Yeah. So they'll be able to see it. We're going to be doing it all
day. Represent. Good. Most definitely. Good. Most definitely. So thanks again, right, brother. I appreciate you coming down.
What you do, I'll be listening.
All right. Talk to you later, brother.
Okay.
So listeners out there, we're going to make a transition here to our show, to our guest who's going to be calling in here shortly. We thank Brother Sean for everything that he does and for coming down to share that information. So hopefully you will take advantage of the opportunity to help your community and help this family heal. So what we want to do right now is take a deep breath. Because there's one of the things that we got from Speak Truth this Thursday, that Sister Helen raised, that there's a need for our community, in particular the Black community, to heal. And to have ability to heal, because it's from a tragedy like this into what we're going to be discussing this morning about the shooting deaths at the hands of the police and what even happened to the police. This is our guest calling in, but we're going to take the call here. Are you there, brother? Let me make sure I got this on. All right. Are you there, brother?
Yes.
All right. So what we want to do, Brother Sundiata, is Carol's going to read your article on air, and then we're going to go from there. How about that?
Okay, that's fine.
All right. Go ahead, Sister Carol.
All right. Sundiata Chajua, Real Talk, Repression Breeds Resistance. History, unlike the natural sciences, has few scientific laws. In 1967, Huey P. Newton, leader of the Black Panther Party, identified one historical law when he said, quote, repression breeds resistance. Newton understood that oppressed people constantly challenge their oppression, most often in individualistic, disorganized, and episodic acts. He also knew repression was likely to produce more collective, organized, and sustained resistance. The series of recent high-profile police murders, undergirded by their worsening quality of life, has propelled blacks from relative quietude to perpetual resistance in 2 short years. The seemingly daily videos documenting the police abuse and murder of black children, women, and men is both nauseating and numbing. They appear so often that in some ways these images have become mundane. At first glance, the murders of Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Philando Castile in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, last week seemed quite familiar. Each of the over 300 annual police killings of blacks is so similar that the details of each incident seem unimportant. Police killings of blacks have become routine and now occur more frequently than lynching did at its height in the 1890s. Repression breeds resistance. The struggle between the oppressed and oppressor, and that is the nature of the relationship between blacks and whites in the United States, involves a series of tactical responses to each other's actions. These responses are not simply innovative reactions to each other's moves, but usually represent escalations. Forms of resistance evolve. Since George Zimmerman stalked and executed Trayvon Martin, black people have become hypervigilant. It has become something of a duty to observe traffic stops and use smartphones and social media to document interactions with the police. Young blacks today describe Darren Wilson's killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, as a wake-up call. Brown's killing taught them that black lives matter least. Like Emmett Till's murder for the Black Power Generation, Brown's was the racial encounter that made racial oppression salient for millennials. Brown's killing crystallized the police as the leading threat to black security and survival. In response to the police threat, blacks are again coalescing around a distinct cultural identity and the politics of militant resistance. Awakened, they quickly moved from disorganized individualistic defiance toward more organized and collective forms of resistance. Ferguson, Baltimore, and Chicago. The struggles in each of these cities saw the activists adapt and grow. Ferguson revived the mass demonstrations that were the hallmark of the civil rights movement. Ferguson also provided a glimpse of what scholars call the tactic of urban rebellion. That tactic took center stage in Baltimore. Chicago returned to the struggle to its most powerful weapon, the economic boycott. Repression breeds resistance. Despite Barack Obama's presidency, black people no longer believed in the promised change and know they've fallen back rather than moved forward. In turbulent times like these, time speeds up. People learn faster, become dissatisfied quicker, and are more willing to respond in kind. An allegedly disturbed ex-soldier, Michael Xavier Johnson, responded in kind to the police executions of Sterling and Castile. Johnson shot 12 Dallas police officers, murdering 5. This week, 3 black men were arrested and accused of planning retaliation against the Baton Rouge police. In Georgia and in St. Louis, motorists attempted to assassinate police officers. From Connecticut to Texas, the police are arresting black people who express support for Johnson on social media. Repression breeds resistance. According to a July 16th New York Times CBS News poll, 50% of blacks and nearly as large a percentage of whites were unsurprised by the Dallas shooting. We knew this was coming. The police habitually disrespect and indiscriminately maim and murder black people. They are rarely prosecuted, and if tried, sympathetic white juries refuse to convict them. Black folks are fed up. Folks are dreaming new dreams, angry dreams, dreams of revenge and retaliation. Repression breeds resistance. We may have entered a new and terrifying moment. We can't cross back over the river, but we can prevent the chasm from widening. To do so requires that we stop fooling ourselves. We can't afford to continue the lies and false equivalencies. Though horrible, the retaliatory murder of five police officers pales in comparison to systemic police harassment and murder of black people. Contrary to right-wing propaganda, contemporary policing is a relatively safe occupation. Over the last 35 years, firearm-related fatalities of police has consistently fallen. The country's 900,000 police officers suffered only 41 firearm-related fatalities in 2015 and an all-time low of 31 in 2014. We need to be honest about the role of police in regard to black people. Castile was stopped 50 times and fined over $6,500, mainly for minor traffic violations. Though blacks comprise 7% of the residents in the region where he was murdered, they compose 50% of those arrested. The function of police in regard to blacks is chiefly social control, to regulate their presence in largely white communities and public spaces, and to generate a revenue stream for cities reeling from the ravages of neoliberal policies. To pull back from the abyss requires acknowledging the structural role of police and shifting their focus to genuine crime, especially violent crimes. It requires administering justice to police killers. They must be prosecuted, tried, and convicted, and incarcerated. Until significant numbers of police abusers and murderers are punished, there will be incentives to emulate Micah Xavier Johnson, Repression Breeds Resistance, by Professor Sundiata Chajua, University of Illinois, African-American Studies and History at the University of Illinois, is a member of the North End Men's Breakfast Club.
All right. All right. So thank you, Sister Carol, for reading that.
You're welcome.
And of course, we welcome our guest, our brother Sundiata Chajua, to the show. He is live on the line. And for those of you who are interested in posing questions or making comments, the line that you can call is 217-359-5483. We are streaming live at www.weft.org. You can just click listen live, and you can also join the conversation if you do not pick up the radio frequency. That's weft.org, and click on listen live. Brother Sundiata, are you there?
Yes, sir.
All right. So how you feeling this morning, brother?
I'm feeling fine.
So, you said what is it? Say it again.
It's a little hot, but it's a good morning.
Yeah, it is a little warm. All right. So talk to us. Carol read the article. I'm sure there's been some very interesting comments underneath the article. Yes, indeed. So look, I'm going to jump that off just like this. Why is an article like that and a position that you've taken considered a threat instead of an intellectual and intelligent analysis of or even a warning of some type? Why is it considered some sort of threat?
Well, you know, the main reason is that we're unable to hold a truthful conversation or analysis of the police. It's viewed as a threat by the people who both run the society and by the majority of the white citizenry. So we're in a situation where the idea is that you simply defend the police and you create a set of myths around the police. So one myth is that they're heroes, right? Mm-hmm. Another myth is that, you know, if you interview police officers, 100% of them will say to you that they became a police officer in order to help people. And the public buys that kind of mythology. And when you look a little bit deeper, if we're able to peel back the myths around policing and talk about what their real function is, then that exposes the deep nature of this society, both in terms of the intense level of racism, but also in terms of it exposes the economic system, capitalism, and the way police are used to be the first line in the protection of private property, right? And so it creates a kind of real conversation that this society has never been willing to have. You know, I can expound a little bit further on these on these myths, right? So let me just with police officers claiming that they joined, they became a police officer in order to help people. Like I said, about 100% of them.
Hey, so Diana, let's qualify this then just a little bit, because you also work as a trainer. You've been working in that capacity. We won't say where, right? But we do understand that you've had significant experience dealing with officers who are training to become officers. Is that correct?
Well, they're already officers.
Oh, okay.
They're in their probationary period, and they're. This is called recruits.
Okay.
But they are functioning officers during the probationary period.
Okay.
I've participated in a training of around 300 at this point.
Okay.
And so this is coming in part from the research data that we gather, in part from things that officers say, right, and those kinds of interactions. Now, what I've always found quite curious is that when you talk to children and you ask them, you know, what they want to do, and they say they want to help people, they would tend to say they want to be a teacher, a coach, a doctor, right? Something that we know that genuinely aids people, but a police officer. And you can't get them to go further. You know, you're not dealing with a population that's self-reflective, and what I mean by that, that looks critically at themselves, both as individuals and as a profession. So if you say to a police officer, when they come with this myth, that they joined to help people, you know, what I often say is, I became a professor because I wanted to help people learn. But I also became a professor because I had a skill set that particular profession, and I personally enjoy lecturing, right? Mm-hmm. Leading students through a discussion. I get something personally out of that. And if we look at any profession, people do it for both reasons of altruism and for reasons of selfishness. Police officers seem incapable of looking at the selfish aspect, so they're never going to admit that they became police officers in part because of the power, right, that they have over other people. They became police officers because potential lovers are attracted to uniforms, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons, but they only want us to focus on the myth. Further, the idea that policing is dangerous. You know, less than 50 officers are killed on the job in terms of being killed by someone that they're engaging, right? Mm-hmm. One of the highest numbers of police deaths is single car accidents. And so they don't want you to do it. In fact, police officers, in my experience, when you present them with statistical data, that really enrages them. Mm-hmm. They get angry. They don't want to deal with it. But the public, we bought the myth. We don't peel back the story and take it as simply one perspective that needs to be investigated and either confirmed or disconfirmed. And, you know, and they're bought with greater complexity. I'm not saying that everything that they say is untrue. I'm just saying that that these things are complex and there are other factors that need to be looked at.
So we're dealing with, at this particular point, you've been sort of unearthing and challenging the myth that police officers join only to serve in a capacity to help people. But there are lots of other reasons why, and you name those things. What particularly jumped out to me was that when you start talking about the statistics of the in the country, the 900,000 police officers, uniformed police officers, and you said in 2014, I think 31 of them were killed. In 2015, 45 were killed out of 900,000.
And the firearm-related.
Firearm-related deaths, meaning that they were shot or gunned down in the line of duty.
Both of those years, there was, I think, 105 in 2014 and maybe 100 in 2015.
Mm-hmm. Total for various different reasons.
Let's take Donald Trump. You know, in Trump's acceptance speech, he says that the killings of police officers is 50% higher in 2016 than the previous year, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, anytime someone gives you a statistic, gives you a percentage without a raw number,
that's right,
they're deliberately trying to cover up something.
Okay.
And what Trump was covering up is that, one, the raw number is so low that it wouldn't get people exercised, right?
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't get the emotional reaction if he used the raw number. Two, he's lying about the 50% increase.
Okay.
He's simply wrong. He's not simply wrong. He's lying, which is different than just being wrong.
Right, right. So one of the things that as we think about any particular profession that does require a citizen or a human being to put themselves in the line of fire, so to speak, whether it's firemen, police officers, and a dog catcher. I don't care. There is a certain amount of risk, right, associated with the job. So what would you say to someone who says, look, you can't characterize this profession as a safe profession, or that you're coming across as if that it's not a dangerous profession?
I think the injuries in terms of police officers also.
We can't hear you, Sundiata.
I think if you look at injuries, that is also a very low figure. Now, the key is this. Being a police officer is potentially dangerous. And the emphasis is on potential. Day to day, the average police officer, right, never draws their weapon, whether it's taser, nightstick, or gun. 50% of police officers in their career without having pulled a weapon. And if you go through and you ask and you look at a log of their day, you're not going to find a large number of episodes in which they're in a confrontation that could go badly.
Mm-hmm.
So the emphasis is on potential, right? These are not firemen who run into a fire in which things are in a bad situation. So to characterize them as heroes is a mistake. They are potentially heroes. There are many police officers who have performed heroic acts.
Mm-hmm.
But that's different than saying that you got 900,000 people in the profession and you therefore you have 900,000 heroes. Mm-hmm. That's not it. And when I say that it's relatively safe, what I mean is that, look, statistically, a clerk in 7-Eleven or any of those convenience stores is more likely to be killed on the job by a huge number than are police officers.
Hmm.
And that's why the point I'm trying to make is that in most things we allow the data and the historical evidence to guide us in making these kinds of determinations.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the police, we make it on the basis of
exceptionalism and emotion, right? You know,
yes, mm-hmm. Right? We're not guided by the evidence.
Hmm. That's an interesting
point.
That's all I'm
saying is that, you know, if we look at most occupations, we have a criteria for determining whether or not something is dangerous. And that has to do with fatalities on the that are job related and injuries that are job related.
Hmm.
And by that criteria, policing is very low.
So then why do we have this, why is this promoted, in your opinion? And we'd ask any of the listeners out there to join us to offer your perspective or to challenge something, to ask a question at 217-359-5483. 217-359-5483. So, Brother Sundiata, why, in your opinion, do you think we have this this myth, these myths, and this pedestal that we put police officers on if the data does not support this sort of heroic image? What is that all about?
It has to do with the function that they play. So let me answer this by way of throwing out a question, right?
Okay.
We know that television is one of the ways in which we are socialized into a sense of what's to be valued and what's to be devalued. Well, when you think about the number of police officers in the society relative to other occupations, right? How do you account for the fact that police shows probably constitute 20% of television shows, particularly in prime time? Why is that profession picked out to be honored in such a way, right? And so it gets back to the role. The essential function of police in this society is to protect the status quo, to protect and preserve the current socioeconomic arrangement. That's the role that they play, and that explains why everything is done in society to make their role appear to be heroic, to appear to be essential and positive and good, rather than to, you know, peel back the onion and let's have a critique of this, you know.
Carol has a question for you.
To be that way. Let me make this one quick point.
Okay.
Police officers are the only group in this society that are sanctioned to use deadly force in the society. Okay. The military, you know, they're not sanctioned to use deadly force in the U.S., right? The police officers are. So you would think that the group that is allowed to use deadly force, you would expect that you would have very high and difficult requirements for such a group.
Yes.
But they actually have the lowest occupational requirements. Many police departments only require a high school diploma. Now, just imagine you're from one of these small all-white towns of 4,000 people, 900 people. What type of quality high school education do you think they receive? To be put in there. Then they turn out to be, you know, they're hired at a very young age. 22, 23, 24. Where they're quick to make decisions. I mean, why do you give people who are so lowly educated, poorly trained, and so young the power of life and death?
I think that's a really profound set of analysis and question, because you have all these other different ways to, and I think it's connected to something. You made me think about something about the you can't smoke, right? And you can't drink until you're 21 or something like that. It's somewhere in that range, right? You know, it's definitely for drinking, right? But you can go to the military and kill people at 18, right? You can become a police officer, at this very young age and have this power in your hand as well, right? And why? There's something connected to the exploitation of young people, right? You know, or the use.
The military says that they want them to come right from high school because it's easier to shape them. That's what it's. That's the purpose of getting them at the young age.
Okay.
Sister Carol, State Representative Carol, you just hit it the nail on the head.
That's the purpose.
They want young people that they can indoctrinate. Right? Because, and again, I'm not trying to say that we shouldn't have sympathy for police officers.
Right.
but the sympathy should be more around the ways in which they are turned into attack dogs against the general population, right? We know that police officers have, that they suffer immensely for the role that they play.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
They have, they're probably the profession with the highest level of alcoholism. They're certainly the profession with the highest level of spousal abuse.
Suicide.
So they suffer for the role because the things that they do, just like soldiers in foreign countries, right? It's hard to live with that as a human. And so, what you out in these other ways?
So, I wanted to ask one of the questions that I think what came up under your article, and I don't know, you know, when you place your articles, if you look back at the comments from people, I often don't, but one of the responses was in response to your articles, is this supposed to justify killing the police officers? Is that what you're attempting to do with your analysis?
You know, this is, I say what I mean, right? I know that, you know, I have enough resources that if I'm one of these people that they've, you know, the police have been systematically pulling people in and arresting them, people who say things like Michael Johnson's a hero, that kind of stuff. But I know that I have enough resources that I can fight such a silly charge, because the reality is that you have to, you arrest and punish people for what they do, not for what they say. You know, that's why we have a First Amendment. But no, I'm not encouraging. I'm simply using the skills as a scholar and as a person that's been an engaged citizen to know that if there's one historical lesson that we can all agree on, it is that repression produces resistance. And that's what I'm trying to put out. The article was meant to do two things. To give people a sense of how in 2 years, young activists had moved from a Martin Luther King kind of position, and I mean the early King, not the later King, but the early King, to a position of armed retaliation. Why that happened, right?
And then secondly, to
warn, you know, there's an implicit warning there that we have to pull back. And the only way to pull back is justice. And justice means that when you hold a person down and you fire off several rounds into their chest, and then somehow the person gets turned over, and you fire off rounds into their back, that this is not complex. This is murder. And that if you keep doing those kinds of things, you will see police officers, you will begin to see other groups, right, treated in the same way. People are not going to put up with this kind of stuff. So that's the spirit in which it was written.
So I appreciate that, because I want to mention a name to you, and then I'm going to share just a little excerpt with you and ask you how this relates to this period, and I think you'll pick it up right away. The gentleman's name is Robert S. Abbott. Do you know that name?
Of course
you do. Because Robert S. Abbott was the founding member and writer for the Chicago Defender.
Right.
In the 1900s, of course, you know that the Chicago Defender began to write about the conditions, which is why this paper was founded in the first place, the conditions of Black people and the wanton murders that were taking place in the 1900s. And the violence against Blacks in the South. And in this particular one, I just found it to be interesting, because I want you to give us the actual analysis of this. It says by 1916, the Defender was distributed in 71 cities and towns throughout the United States and in the South secretly by the Pullman porters, because the paper was banned in the South. It says at one point, the point being, that it appeared in the life of Black people when Black people were being treated in a, or it was revealing the treatment of Black people to the rest of the United States. After the murder, of course, of Emmett Till In 1955, the paper had reached its all-time height, showing on the cover of the Chicago Defender the murder of Emmett Till. Whites at the same time were in disbelief. Tell me, give us an analysis of what is not only written in your article, but other independent journalists are doing around the current system problems around these murders as it relates to the murders and lynchings of blacks in the South during Robert Emmett's time.
Thank you. I'm really glad you chose that particular example, because one of the reasons, as you pointed out, that the Chicago Defender was founded was to expose the violence against black people. Right. So when the Defender appears, it's at the height of lynching, and the Defender routinely tracks lynchings. Right. So they report whenever there's a lynching, and we know that there was a lynching every 2.5 days at its height. But the other thing that the Defender did is it tracked black resistance to lynching. Okay? Mm-hmm. So it reported when black people rose up, right? It reported the forms of resistance. Now, another piece that's implicated here, and this is at the beginning of World War II, the Pittsburgh Courier had kind of taken the lead and called for what's been known as the Double V campaign. And Double V meant victory abroad against fascism. And we have to understand that fascism means militarism, right, racism, extreme exploitation. That's the nature of what fascism is. So there's a racial component in fascism, hence the genocide against Jewish people that was endemic to that, genocide against the Roma, or what people call the gypsies, attempts to commit genocide against gays in fascist countries, right? So we know that that's part of that piece. But in the United States, the response, right, because the other part of Double V, in addition to victory abroad, was victory at home against racism. And so the Defender was part of that. And what the federal government attempted to do, right, was they threatened black editors that if they continued to write about racial discrimination, about exploitation on the plantations of the South, about police killings of blacks in the North, right, just exposing the general racist character and the racial pressure under which black people North and South lived, that they were going to shut them down, right? They were going to arrest the editors. And fortunately, black people had enough clout that they were able to fight that. But that's the initial intent, right, of these kinds of regimes, is to respond with repression because they don't want the word out. Mm-hmm. And so what happens, my column's not unique. There's all kind of black folks and some white folks and other folk, Latinos writing and exposing what's going on in that way. And I like to think that this collection of, thousands of people who expose racism, class exploitation, et cetera, that it has had some impact on the public, and that in part explains the reason why the move to shut these things down, to attack, right? But never attack on the basis of evidence and argument, but simply to make an emotional rant, to charge, to say something like you're disrespecting the police whose lives were taken. But no, I'm explaining to you why these lives were taken. And trying to get folks to understand that it will continue unless you begin to make justice the main objective here.
So I want to take a minute to interject a poem that I wrote in 2009 or 2010, because it's very similar. I feel this on a regular basis of trying to bring issues to whether it's city council, county board, the chiefs of police, and to the even to a broader community, and it feels as though it's perceived as some sort of threat. That's why I sort of asked you that question early on. And so this was written around 2010, almost 6 years ago. It's called Construction of Injustice. Investing in lies and blaming the youth. Ruminate. Murder is designed to hide the truth. Murder is designed to hide the truth. Murder is designed to hide the truth. Five deaths in the Champaign County jails in less than 2 years. Inmates beaten and tased by officers / overseers. Is legal lynching the new scoop? Officer Yort escapes with a history of sexual misconduct and physical evidence of a rape. The response from his friends is political jargon. 13-year veteran Sergeant Myers repeatedly sends 50,000 volts of electricity into detained citizens and is rewarded with a plea bargain. Overcharging persists, and it's a damn shame. Obstruction of justice, obstruction of justice, obstruction of justice. Judge Heidi Ladd sentenced Terrell Layfield to 6 years in prison for giving a false name. Our condolences to the other four men, Marcus Edwards, Joseph Beavers, William D. Marshall, and Quentin Larry, who died on Memorial Day weekend. Abuse of power, malicious prosecution as retribution, all to instill fear, unequal protection under the law, and the message is clear. We do what the hell we want to do. And the same thing that happened to Amber Grow Hall, Patrick Thompson, Kiwan Carrington, etc., can happen to you. For those of you who don't believe this piece, pick up your camcorder and start videotaping the police. Start tracking their actions on the streets in your community. Do some research and find out how many young females get raped by officers that are on duty. Rodney King and Amadou Diallo are just two of the obvious constructions of injustice. There's a long history of bogus cops receiving slaps on the wrist. Now Champaign County can add four more names to that growing list. But I guarantee you this, at some point, the poor and repressed will get tired of this shit. There will be no respect for authority and no trust in the system. There will be mass civil unrest and everyone will be a victim. Construction of injustice.
That's powerful, and it does. You have in a very short piece distilled the essence of the contemporary experience of Black and poor people, and you know, and expressed it in a way that is truly profound.
And the intent, as you, just with your article, I mean, it's just like, so you have an artist was from a poem perspective and a scholar from historical analysis, just saying it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that you're not going to keep sending our children home in body bags, and we just going to keep praying about it. America didn't do that. I remember so vividly Bush, George Bush, President Bush at that time, saying that about 9/11, his words exactly, never forget them. God may have mercy on you, but we won't. That's what he said about these attackers, right? This is America. You mess with us, we gonna retaliate. And you bomb Pearl Harbor, we dropping atomic bomb on you, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So how you gonna act like you don't understand? Maybe it's just because you think Black folks shouldn't resist this. I don't know.
I'm going to ask the professor a question in relationship to that. Because as we've watched this over and over again on television, there seems to be a air of amazement that there is a violent response to this. At what period of time did Black people decide that they just weren't going to take it no more? At what point, right, in history do we see this history repeating itself today?
You know, when you put it that way, it is amazing, right? But again, myths have to be propagated, right? And so what happens, even though Martin Luther King represents a complete anomaly in African-American history, right? First of all, when else have ministers led the black community other than during the civil rights period? That's the only period in which ministers have led the black community. Two, the doctrine of nonviolence for King is not just a tactic, right? It's not a strategy. For King, it's a philosophy of life. That has never been a philosophy of the African-American liberation movement. The movement has always held out armed self-defense and, when necessary, retaliation. So it's a complete misread of African-American history, but here's the thing, right? Overwhelmingly, very few people in this society, white and unfortunately even black folks, know African-American history. Know that we have always responded. You know, an analysis I've done of lynching, looking at about 500 lynching episodes that we selected randomly, in about 15% of the cases, black people collectively organized armed resistance to retaliate. You know, and there's other forms of resistance. So, yes, black folks have always resisted. It's a human response to repression is to resist it in kind. People attack you, you fight to defend yourself, and at some point, in order to stop their attacks, you take it to them. That is a basic human response. But what the society has done is that it's tried to convince black folks that we have to be long-suffering, that we are never to respond in kind. And yet everything about resistance, right, shows that when you respond in kind, you're more likely to stop that behavior. That's why Ida B. Wells, you know, when people teach Ida B. Wells, and again, where does Ida B. Wells get taught? Black studies classes, maybe a couple women's studies classes, you know, a quick mention. But what Ida B. Wells said is that she had done all of these analyses of lynching, right? This is the red record, where she goes through statistically and points out how many lynchings were occurring in the country. And Ida B. Wells said that in looking at the lynchings, the only time the lynching was prevented was when African-Americans took up arms. And so she concluded that a Winchester rifle should have an honored place over the mantle of every African-American household. Now, and that's always been the reality. Look, white people, you know, the people who run this society, they just lie so much and falsify things. Now, they made a revolution, right? They broke away, killed, fought, you know, used every possible tactic against England over something that they called taxation without representation. We have been slaughtered as a people, systematically murdered and oppressed. But for us to rise up, you know, Nat Turner's portrayed as insane.
Right.
To rise up against slavery.
That's just crazy, right?
You
should not rise up and push back against slavery.
You should not rise up against your oppression. Only white folks get to do that. Okay? Everywhere where whites have risen up against oppression, it's something that's to be honored. When we rise up, there's something wrong with us, we're overreacting, you know. This is just absurd.
So
the bottom line is that it doesn't matter what leaders say anyway. People who are abused will respond.
So I wanted to ask you a question. I've been watching the, again, the coverage on the news goes from talking about the videotaped murders of these two young men to then the killings of the police officers. And now the discussion is, it's Black Lives Matter's fault. There is another period of time that kind of reminds me of. And I can't help but think about the Black Panthers and Huey P. Newton, and they're rising up against oppression. And the response from the public was that they need to go, not the repression. Can you talk about that?
But the resistance need to go, not the repression, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's always going to be the response, because the idea is to project a society as having at best minor flaw, right? So the notion is that America.
Can you repeat that again? Repeat that again.
The idea is to say that the society only has minor flaws. In the case of the United States, right, they always push this notion of exceptionalism, mm-hmm. right, American exceptionalism. See, this is the thing about how unknowing the American people are and how the people in positions to educate systematically produce myths and lies. So the notion of American exceptionalism, you know who was the first to utter that term and use that concept?
Who was that?
Members of the American Communist Party in response to Stalin. Stalin was arguing, y'all need to make a revolution. And you had the working class rise up. And the American Communist, the leadership of the American Communist Party in the 1930s, they said, America is exceptional. We don't have the kind of class-based thing that you have in old European societies, so it's much harder. So that's where the notion of American exceptionalism originates, with the American Communist Party in a debate with Stalin. Yet you can turn on your TV at any point now, and you'll hear some person talk about American exceptionalism and never take it back to where the term comes from and how it was used in an argument, you know, initially to make an argument. So that's just one point about what we don't know. And because we know the least about the nature of our society, we're easily manipulated by myths and lies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always easier to project to people that this society is damn near perfect. And if there is a problem, the problem is with the individuals or the groups. In the case of Black folk, and speaking of the comments you mentioned in terms of in response to my the latest column, several of those people, and also in letters as well as online comments, they come back and say the problem in the Black community is the broken Black family, as they describe it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is not that we're oppressed. The problem is our form of what they call family disorganization. Because if you begin to talk in terms of the nature of the society, right, then you're exposing that at the end of the day, right, it really is a society constructed in such a way that you got the 99% and you got the 1%. It is a society in which overwhelmingly, right, white people are bought off by the 1% white folks who run the society to oppose Blacks, Browns, and you know, other people of color, and to maintain this unified facade with white folks. Like, you know, just think about it. The people at these people are going to vote for Donald Trump. Now, most of them are middle class, and they're little shop owners, right? A lot of them. I mean, the base, Trump's base, is the small business people. Well, small business people are the base for which fascism comes. But for those people who are workers, right, lower middle class folks, those people, they are attaching themselves to Donald Trump and the Trump candidacy for essentially racist reasons. And when they look and see that their income has declined over the past 35 years, they look and see that their quality of life has worsened. Do they blame the 1% or do they blame the 13% Black folk who live worse than they do? And that's the nature of the society. And that's why you never go after, in this society, they never want to talk about systemic racism and exploitation. they always want to put the emphasis on the behavior of folks. So don't talk about oppression and police murder. Talk about the response to it. Now, when the black people, when they kill black people, we look up and within a day or two, we know what that brother did in second grade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these white cops, they're always presented as innocent. Even Obama played that foolish game. Now, those five Dallas cops that were killed, one of them we know was a white supremacist. Hmm. He was a Ahern was a white supremacist. He's got all the paraphernalia of white supremacists. He's got the Iron Cross tattoo on the finger, right? You go to his webpage, his Facebook page, he's got Thor's hammer, all of these emblems of white supremacy. Now, even the FBI said that in the 1990s, the white supremacist movement targeted police for entry. They joined the police forces. Hmm. Now, how many of these shootings are simply the work of white supremacists? I know it's not the majority because it's far worse to understand that the average person in the white person in the United States has been socialized to be racist. The average black person, Latino person has been socialized to have internalized racism, right? To have disdain for their own group. That these are the people who are doing the shootings. That's part of the way the society is structured. But rather than talk about that, you want to talk about how people respond. Never interrogate the shooters. Let's go through the other four Dallas police officers. How many of them had complaints against them? In Baton Rouge, it turns out that those guys had complaints. One had previously killed a black person the year before.
Hmm.
Unarmed black subject the year before. You know, and again, then what we're told is that these people were, they're saying, well, the police who have been tried, and let's be clear, in the last decade, only 65 police officers have been charged, right, with killing. Usually it's manslaughter. And only 11 were convicted. And so we're supposed to believe, right, that the 54 that were found not guilty and the hundreds that were uncharged, that they were not guilty of a crime, and we should, as they say, forgive and move on. But OJ wasn't convicted of a crime. He was found not guilty. And every white person in this country would tell you OJ committed the murder, right? And they'll go on to dog OJ. Now, what I'm saying is simply this. It's not a question whether I believe OJ committed the murder. From their point of view, right? The point of view is that he was found not guilty. But when we say we disagree with the official finding, we have reason to believe something different. Then we're told just get in line and accept the official finding.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's a point at which you can be so damn unfair, right, mm-hmm. that you actually push people to retaliation because you're simply unwilling to apply the same standards that you apply to everything else.
All right. I was wondering when somebody was going to call. We got a caller to see. Let's see what they want to say. All right. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
This is Jim Hyman. Dr. Sumbiata, the leader of the Communist Party that made the term American exceptionalism was Eugene Dennis.
Yes.
Who I want you to talk about that almost never gets talked about is Robert F. Williams from Monroe, North Carolina. His book is called Negroes with Guns, and there is a documentary on him as well. He was considered the godfather of the Black Panther Party, but in the documentary, his name never comes up. Did you I hope you have something to add.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you for that question, and particularly for bringing up Robert F. Williams. You know, Malcolm X is generally perceived as the leading challenger to Martin Luther King. But in the late 50s, the person that challenged King around the question of armed self-defense was Robert F. Williams out of Monroe, North Carolina. And Williams, his profile speaks directly to this question of resistance. So this may take me about 3 minutes.
Go for it, man. Go for it.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right. So one, a big historical point is that there is an irony in history. You know, as black folks say, things that go around come around.
Yes.
So when you think about something like the Haitian Revolution, right, the leadership of the Haitian Revolution in terms of Henri Christophe and Jacques Dessalines, where did they get their military training? The French brought them to the U.S. to fight on the side of the white Americans against the English. And when they went back to Haiti, they applied the skills that they learned to overthrow the French and create the independence of Haiti. Robert Williams is a black man who joined the U.S. military in World War II, like hundreds of thousands of black men that have fought in the U.S. military. Williams fought to make the world safe for democracy. He fought to end fascism, racism, etc. Then he comes back home to Monroe, North Carolina, and he sees the conditions of black folks are just like they were when he left, and he's incensed. So he becomes the head of the local NAACP. And there's a situation where black kids are dying swimming in this old stream, right? It's dangerous. So Williams leads the movement to go to the city council and ask them, and get this, they ask, can black folks use the city pool one day a week? And the city council deliberates. And the city council comes back and they tell them that it's cost prohibitive. You say, well, what? It's cost prohibitive because we'd have to drain, clean, and refill the pool after y'all used it. Right?
Wow.
That leads Williams to more aggressive action. The Klan attempts to assassinate a black doctor in Monroe, North Carolina. So Williams forms a rifle group. The Klan comes through every weekend and they shoot up the black community. Williams, as head of the local NAACP, goes before the city council and he says, can you stop the Klan from coming in and shooting into the homes of black people and people who they find on the fringe? If they're women, they rape them. If they're men, they beat them. Can you stop that? The city council says the Ku Klux Klan has a right to march and organize in the city just like the NAACP. So the next time the Klan comes into the black community, the rifle club that Robert Williams formed, they shoot it out with them, and the Klan is sent scurrying. City council goes into emergency session the next Monday, and they issue an ordinance saying that the Klan can no longer march in the city limits of Monroe, North Carolina. Then there's a pregnant black woman who a white man knocks on her door, bursts in, and rapes her. He doesn't even show up for the trial. And they say something like, why would a good Christian white man rape a beast? And he's clear. And Robert Williams says, we, from now on, if the government will not protect black life, we will beat violence with violence. Right? And so what makes Williams a high point is that he then debated King. And where King talked about this very restrictive, you must always function from the standpoint of a philosophy of nonviolence, Williams called for tactical flexibility. And he said, you know, you don't use wire pliers to undo a bolt. Excuse me, you don't use a screwdriver to undo a bolt. You got to have the right tool for the right problem. And if the problem is that they are killing us, we have to respond with armed self-defense, right? So he called for tactical flexibility. So I want to thank the caller again for bringing up Robert Williams' name. And his book documenting this is, of course, the famous Negroes with Guns.
And is that separate from Deacons with Defense? For Defense?
Deacons for Defense would also grow up, but they would come out of Louisiana, a small town in Louisiana. And again, what's interesting is that this is a group of 40, 50, 60-year-old men involved in the church, right? Hence the name Deacon.
Mm-hmm.
And they had watched these young civil rights activists being brutalized by the Klan and these white mobs, by the sheriff's office, either observed or participated in the beatings, right? Mm-hmm. They said, well, this is not going to carry on. So they armed themselves and marched with the civil rights demonstrators to ensure that there would, in fact, be peace. And guess what?
No problem. I know we got to wrap up here. I just wanted to make a connection to something because Carol brought up the Black Lives Matter piece, and then Jim called in with the Robert Williams. And so you said Robert Williams responded by, if the government won't protect black life, then we will, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And it's very similar because, see, the whole mantra of Black Lives Matter is that the community and the black community across the country has said black lives matter least, as the way you pointed out in one of your articles. Therefore, the government is, I mean, this is state sanctioned violence. Yes, we can get into a conversation about black on black or intra-racial violence, as Gus talks about. But what we're discussing is state sanctioned violence, where, in essence, the government is not protecting black life. You can't get the feds to come in, the Department of Justice to investigate any of these or to actually arrest anybody. Therefore, Micah and some of these other folks say, oh, OK, we right back to where we were before. Right.
Yeah.
The whole thing with Black Lives Matter is that you won't protect the life of black folks. Right. And we just getting gunned down all over the place, our young men, young black men. And so then you start to get the Micahs who are thinking in the same vein that Robert Williams, but also need to be, they're not as organized necessarily. They didn't pull a group together for the protections. Carol wanted to say something.
I did want to, you can have it. I'm just going to throw out, cause you brought it up with, Robert, F. Williams. So just prior to the shootings in Dallas, prior to the killing of, Philando and what's the other
Minnesota.
In Minnesota. And what was the brother?
Austin Sterling.
In New Orleans.
Sterling in Baton Rouge. Right.
So just prior to that, maybe 2 months ago, I read an article in a newspaper about a white supremacist group that was at that point harassing Muslim mosques in different cities. But this one turns out that they showed up at a mosque in Dallas, Texas. And when they showed up at that mosque with their weapons to harass the Muslims at this particular mosque, there were armed black members that were part of a group.
And non-members
that were part of a group called Huey P. Newton Gun Club. And this happened 2 months before this ultimate thing in Dallas took place. Now, the authorities aren't paying attention because the police are present, as the article describes it, when this white supremacist group comes upon this black mosque. But they don't intervene and push them out of there. They stand afar and watch this episode with these armed, again, members of the Huey P. Newton Gun Club. I just want to give you that as you think about these Robert F. Williams and what his response was, and Negroes with Guns.
Let's be clear. There's 5 to 7 organized groups of armed blacks whose position is armed self-defense and retaliation in Dallas. So one of the things you got to ask yourself is, why does Dallas have such a large proliferation of armed black groups?
That's
a
question.
Not just the UEP Newton Gun Club, it's the New Black Panther Party, and it's a few more. Okay? Why in Dallas? Well, it has something to do with the nature of the Dallas police and their oppression. Now, in the last year, you know, they got this new black chief and he's trying to clean things up. But there's only so much, as we know, and there's only so much you can do with a black chief. But the point I want to make, as my time is running out, Aaron, is around the Black Lives Matter analogy that you throw out. And what I want to say is this. We got to be critical of ourselves as well. Black Lives Matter sounds like Martin Luther King in the late 60s. They don't sound like Robert F. Williams. Okay? Maybe not as, and when we say Black Lives Matter, we got to be very careful because there's two things that exist. There's the slogan right off the hashtag, and then there's the Black Lives Matter Network, the actual organization. Very few things that are happening in this country have anything to do with the Black Lives Matter Network. Okay? They barely exist nationally in a way to lead things. Most of these demonstrations are led by local groups, and a Black Lives Matter contingent shows up with flyers and posters, and the media is more comfortable going there. Even now while they're criticizing them, they're comfortable going there because of what that group represents, right? As opposed to a deep analysis that goes in and looks at what's happening locally in these communities. Mm-hmm. So, for example, New York Times did something on the protest, I guess it's now 2 weeks ago, the initial protest coming out of the murder of Philando Castile and the murder of Alton Sterling and the killings of the police officers in Dallas, right? Mm-hmm. And so they got like a 2-page article, and it all begins Black Lives Matter, move Black Lives Matter. And then when you get into the last third, on the second page, they say that the demonstration was organized by this group. And the group is not Black Lives Matter. It's a local group. You understand? So right. there was a vested interest in MSNBC promoting Black Lives Matter Network. But the Black Lives Matter Network has never been central to these protests, to any of these things. These are local blacks who are rising up, and they have their own way of understanding things.
Well, one of the things that I
got to be clear about that.
And I appreciate the clarity. What I was trying to do was to say that the announcement, even if it's the hashtag, of Black Lives Matter, has raised a conversation because some people say all lives matter and blue lives matter, right? But based upon the analysis and the statistics that you shared, our numbers is that police killings or vigilantes is something like 300-500 a year of black folks being gunned down, right? Where we're saying that the police officers are being killed at gun violence by the by people that they are in some sort of struggle with, 31 or 45 in a year.
So and most of those killings are by whites killing police, not black.
And so the point being that the reason why Black Lives Matter, of course, we don't have to explain this to each other, but to the listeners, the whole mantra and the shout, the slogan, the hashtag of Black Lives Matter is saying that overall, the black community and those who are sensitive to this in the society are saying that it appears as though it doesn't. And so there's this, the point being that it resonated with me that you said, Robert F. Williams said, hey, okay, if this doesn't matter, if black lives don't matter to you, then, and we can't count on the government to do nothing about it, then we will. So that was the only reason why I made the connection, was that we're in that same time that there's an announcement.
I understood you're making the connection, but I was trying to speak to the wider audience because we can't allow these myths to continue to be propagated. And if we allow the notion that the Black Lives Matter Network has anything to say that's worth listening to at this moment in history, right, we're misleading our people. We build from the last high point. We don't need to return to 1955, right? That wasn't the high point of the movement. We need to build from the high point of the movement. And that has more to do with Robert F. Williams than it has to do with the young king.
Okay. So we should definitely have you back on and to dig a little bit deeper into that.
Yes, I
wanted to just say thank you, brother, for taking the time to share with us We're going to try to take this last 20 minutes and close out, try to talk about a couple other things as we head off to the convention and try to tie these things into the convention and what's coming up politically for the country and the presidential race and Congress and all those types of things. But I wanted to say thank you. I appreciate you. And we will definitely be in touch with
you
soon.
Thank you for the lesson.
And everybody should tell them about the column. How often does the column come up and all that kind of stuff?
The column comes out on the first and third Sunday.
We can't hear you. Say that again.
The column comes out on the first and third Sundays. You know, if I could just put in a plug, I would say this. The right wing of this area, they wage a tremendous assault on the ideas pushed forward in the column, both in terms of online and often in letters to the editor. What we need is for those people who find value in the ideas expressed in the column to express themselves as vigorously as the opponents do.
So this is the first and third Sunday, Real Talk with Sundi Adichajua, right? All right, so y'all got it. Y'all heard it. News Gazette, you can get it online, or if you're buying the paper physically, most folks can read it online. Real Talk with Sundi Adichajua, first and third Sunday. He has a column in there, and you need to read it every time, every chance you get. Thanks again, brother. We appreciate you. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Sister Carol.
That was really a lesson, a history lesson that I would love to see us have a real public discussion where, you know, you hear people and you read their comments on the internet, but they won't come forward and sit down and talk to you and bring what they find to be, you know, the other side.
Bring their arguments
to the
table.
Bring your arguments, bring your facts with you. They love to do that on the internet and as opposed to in person.
Under anonymous names.
Under anonymous names, so you don't have to be revealed. But I think the only way to deal with this is with honest, truthful dialogue and bring the research and let's compare the notes. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I found...
And grow from it.
Found interesting. Well, some people won't grow. Some people won't
grow. But that would be the intention, right?
The intention for us is to... We want to get rid of a society that produces the level of injustice that brings us to this moment in history. We cannot speak about this as if it is a singular incident that came completely out of nowhere. We must talk about it in the context for which it exists. And Black Lives Matter slogan, the hashtag itself, was, I think, brought about to bring to the fore these things that are happening in communities that the larger white society don't get to see. As it was when Emmett Till was killed, right? So it wasn't brought to the larger society until the Chicago Defender put that on the cover and it went around the world. So that is important for people. Unfortunately, it makes white folks uncomfortable to know that your society is producing this level of injustice. But it has been, and we have to actually deal with it. But the slogan Black Lives Matter is not just about the interactions with police. And if we talk about that in the context for which Sundiata just put it out, it's about policies that are producing this level of injustice between the people who's supposed to serve and protect and the people they're supposed to protect in the society. It also shows and develops this idea of the lack of opportunity in jobs, in educational, in criminal justice, the courts. We can go on and on and on where you see disparities between Black people in the society and white people in the society. And those are produced out of something. They don't just come out of thin air. And people got to be honest about that. I see it as a legislator when you're arguing about trying to reform systems. Some people say we need to diminish them because you can't reform them. But in the case that we're trying to use policy to correct some of this, they are vehemently fought against by largely people on the other side of the aisle and absolutely people that are non people of color. And so we just have to deal with these issues. And that's what this is all about. Why are you smiling like that?
Because what is non people of color? What does that mean? Okay.
Non people of color.
So look, whether it's terminology, the high emotion, justified high emotions, where is the direction and how do you respond to this? Right. You know, because it's happening. It can't be ignored. And I'm talking about the in particular, the every day opening up the paper, reading about state sanctioned violence against African-American people, males in particular. But poor people, for sure, because we also get more and more of Latinos and also more and more of poor whites also. But the vast majority, it's all, you know, when we turn on the news, it's Orlando, it's Alton Sterling, it's Philando Castile, it's, you know, the guy who was just shot in Florida with his hands up laying on the ground as a therapist, shot in the leg. He asked the police, why you shoot me? He said, I don't know. Hmm. Right. There's certainly a something that's happening in the country that has to be addressed. And look, people talk about the intra-racial violence that takes place in our community here or in other communities. Well, what's consistent is that intra-racial violence is very much associated with retaliation
for something. Yeah.
Some actual wrong or some perceived wrong,
yeah.
Right? And now you're seeing that retaliation and response, resistance to repression is also showing up in the state-sanctioned violence, right? So even if you have that conversation, what you see is that resistance to repression or assaults and attacks is real, right? And that's just, if you don't want that, then don't bother people. Don't shoot people
where there's
unjustly,
no justice, there's
right?
no peace. You can't have peace where there's no justice. You know, all history tells us that. All history. Not just black history, but European history. You know, look at Ireland. Where there is no justice, there is no peace. You have to create just societies.
So
that's the point.
Move forward. We've got about 10 minutes left. And we're trying to we have moved into a political realm, electoral politics, as well as the organizing and activist stuff that we've done. And we're going to be who we are wherever we go. Headed to the Democratic National Convention on the Florida network, not just for Bernie Sanders, who we were delegates for and are delegates for and plan to use our influence in any way that we possibly can to continue to fight for the issues that Bernie put forth and that the vast, just millions of American people say, look, we support that particular platform. But there are other things that are going to be taking place. There are other networks and other people that we want to try to touch base with around some of these other issues that we see on a regular basis. Because we know that while we fight for justice and advocate for justice with anyone who supports that, we also understand that there's a uniqueness about, there's a reason why it says Black Lives Matter, right? Because you just don't see the assault and the level of killing and murdering that's taking place every place else. So we do have to be specific, and it's not a I have trouble with the whole rising tide floats all boats concept.
Because
right?
History doesn't actually support that idea. That's not how it happens, actually. Yeah. History gives you a better view of how gains are made by the oppressed people in a society. It tells you that.
You know, I wanted to point this out because, look, just like we talk about a lot of nonviolent responses or other methods of addressing issues, whether it's boycotting, they shut down the Magnificent Mile in Chicago. There's been stuff all on the internet about boycotting particular establishments and stuff like that. I believe there's a current boycott of Schnucks because of something that there is a boycott of Schnucks that's going on right now based upon them firing a bunch of Teamsters. But the other thing is that, you know, I saw an article the other day where a lone gentleman of Muslim, of I think he was of Arab descent, who wore his kufi and everything, walked right into the Cleveland public square with an AR-15 strapped across his back and a couple of other weapons. And so, of course, the news, and, you know, they got people in there shouting about Islamophobia and infidels. And I mean, just going on and on and on about Islam. And there he is walking amongst this group of rabid right wing Republicans talking stuff about, you know, Islam and Muslims.
Banning Muslims.
Right. Sharia laws and all kind of different stuff. But there he is all by himself, with an AR-15 and whatever else strapped on him. And the media is like, are you afraid? No, not at all. Have you had any problems? No, none at all. Because just like in the case of most bullies, when you stand up to them and you show that you have no fear, you're just as armed, if not better than them, they don't have much to say then. And he walked around the public square without a problem in the midst of other folks who were shouting those sort of hateful terminology and derogatory comments. And they were armed too, but they didn't bother him, and he was by himself. So if you don't want a society where people are walking around armed and stuff like that, then don't give the appearance that the only way you get peace is through being armed. Right? How would they have treated him by himself walking through there if he ain't had no AR-15 strapped on his back? See, because we've seen what other protesters have done. Whether it was white females or whoever, if they go into a Trump rally just shouting, saying, hey, you know, down with hate, we don't support Trump, they beat them up, steal on them, do all kind of different stuff. We've seen it happen. He walked through there with that AR-15, didn't nobody say nothing to him. I'm just saying, you know, what is the message that you want? If I come here, if I raise an issue, you beat me up, you throw stuff at me, you spit on me, you kick me, you throw me out when I ain't got no weapons. I come through here with AR-15 and don't nobody even speak to me.
I think that this is a very interesting thing to watch.
It's crazy.
You know, we'll be certainly advocating the Democratic National Convention for them to get a bit more wisdom about this and to respond with legitimate response when communities are saying to you, power structure, that we are being not only mistreated, maltreated, and murdered, you need to respond appropriately as a government should respond to protect its citizens. And if you don't, then you leave no option, but the citizens will find whatever course they need to protect themselves. And you don't want to have your society, go backwards. I was going to say something else.
Well,
but,
you know,
it's already been written. This has already been written, and people aren't paying attention to the facts and the history that exists. We want to do the us against them analogy. If you don't stand over here with the police, then you're not standing with the police. You're anti-police and anti. This is ridiculous verbiage that does not bring communities together, and it certainly don't solve the problem that's being brought to the surface by the people who are saying enough is enough.
And so look, we got to wrap it up here. We got about 4 minutes left before we get out of here. And we definitely want to encourage everybody to support this family, the Wiggins and Davis family, the U of I Credit Union Memorial Fund. I believe there's also a GoFundMe page that I saw. And I want to thank everybody who supported the effort that was much needed effort to support me in particular to go on this trip as a delegate, because the cost is outrageous. And I think some 150 some people have helped me raise the money that I needed to go. And I want to thank you from the depth of my heart. I'm humbled by your support, and I will definitely go to this convention and represent the way that I'm supposed to, continue to fight, continue to make them feel the burn, fight for the issues that that are of major concern for us. What else is coming up?
Well, we'll be working certainly when we return.
There's an update. Yeah, when we come back.
Yeah, when we come back on June 30th, which is
July
30th. I'm sorry, I've gone a month back or a year ahead, right? On July 30th, Aaron and I and a few other local folks who are delegates from Illinois We'll meet together on July 30th at 4 o'clock at the Independent Media Center and give a full update of the DNC, the caucuses and councils we attended, some of the things that we got out of it, how we plan to move forward. We'll be doing that at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center on July 30th. You'll get more of that. If you're not on my listserv, you might want to do that and just go to carolammons.com and sign up. Sign up on my listserv so that you can get all the information about what we're doing, when we're doing it. That's just carolammons.com. And that way you'll get the information about the update on July 30th. We welcome everybody to come and hear what we learned.
So one of the other things that I'm sure you'll probably hear later on today as you listen to the news from Neptune and as well as the Labor Hour, one of the things that Brother Gus talks about all the time is, you know, one of the ways a very militant response to some of this outrageous behavior and killings is to withhold your labor. So when will there be a strike, a massive strike of massive proportion to withhold labor and to hold the economic establishment accountable, to make everybody feel it, and so that we can continue this fight forward for justice? So I want to thank everybody for listening. Thank the Jim and the couple people for calling, Brother Sundiata, for your interview and for your support. We appreciate you all. Love and respect you all. Find a way to heal and keep the fight going. So as John Lee Johnson would always say, stay out of trouble. But as Paul Muth likes to say, get in the right kind of trouble. Peace and much love to you.
On the way to Philly, huh?
Yes, we are.
I see.
Yes, we are.
You still got your GoFundMe up?
I do.
Okay. I'll make the pitch if you haven't had to make it lately.
Oh, okay. I sure appreciate it.
Check it out. You can find them on Facebook. Aaron Ammons. My name's Paul Mutha. You give me a little extra minute here. I'll have to pass it on to the Labor Hour. How about that?
A lot, man.
You must have an appointment to make.
No?
Go chill a little bit, please.
Yeah, yeah.
Please. Be safe out there.
We're going to do our best.
And I'm going to kick it off with a couple of commentaries from Black Agenda Reports. They're incendiary as usual. Bruce Dixon, we haven't heard from him in a while, if you're a regular listener. At the top of the hour, I play some short features. And got some Robert Perry and some Gareth Porter favorites of mine. It's sort of looking past all of the brouhaha about election this and election that and looking at some of the real determinants of foreign policy. There is a left critique of NATO. You don't have to just be looking at how much share Lithuania is putting into their defense budget and buying stuff from Lockheed, probably, to be a critic of NATO involvement, which includes Turkey, which is in the Mediterranean Sea. Gareth Porter will be talking about Turkey a bit, and it's pretty fundamental. He mentions that some people in press TV in Iran are talking about how the coup was probably engineered by the U.S. because they didn't like Erdogan's opening to Russia and to